If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
David, as in our own David Plyer.
I was going to say, am I playing Charles Nelson Reilly? Because that might be a little, I have to practice, I guess, for that.
Well, it's easier than Joan Embry, I think.
That's very
but
true.
Just hearing that true. Brings you back, I think, to another time.
Oh, yeah.
Those names, too.
Those names, and that music has been ringing in my head for the last 3 months.
And explain why.
Well, we opened up a couple weeks ago. Steve was there last week, and we opened up the Museum of Broadcast Communications once again, but in a new location, 440 West Randolph, Randolph and Canal, right across from Ogilvy Station. And the big exhibits are Johnny Carson, the Centennial, we opened on his birthday, and the evolution of late night television, which pretty much in the last few months, in reality, has written itself.
You're not kidding.
It? Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the evolution of late night television a little bit. Carson wasn't the first, of course, and there are many people who don't even know Johnny Carson.
That's very true.
So as people walk through there, and they see some of the video that you have mm-hmm. a lot of the classic bits that you show. So I could, to some people, just say Ed Ames, and people will know what I'm talking about.
A generation, yes.
Yeah, but other people won't know. And for those who don't, you can see these videos. Do you find that young people still, they laugh, even if they haven't seen it?
Fascinated, because you're thinking about going to the Museum of Science and Industry, the Field Museum, the Adler, wherever you go, you're learning something new about somebody you didn't know about. So if you're watching anything on your phone or watching something streaming, it had to start somewhere. So what is that history? And I think that's what we are teaching folks. And you asked about the evolution of late night. The first host of a late night show was 75 years ago. It was 1950. And many people don't know this, but it was a woman named Faye Emerson.
Now, I knew of Faye Emerson, but I had no idea.
As an actress, probably.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea she did that.
Yeah, she did that on CBS. Because most history books say it was Broadway Open House, which was a precursor to The Tonight Show. That was the first late night show, but she had interviews, she had music, maybe she cooked a little bit, but it was all about late night.
Well, they cook now.
Conversation. That's very true.
Yeah.
15-minute show, then a half hour show when it went national. It was short lived, but you have to give this woman credit where credit is due.
Nobody, I don't think, has done that.
Well, and you think about it, you can count on one hand how many women have hosted any late night show. You know, Joan Rivers probably being the biggest one, but you got Chelsea Handler, you have Samantha Bee, you have Wanda Sykes did it for a while, but not many.
And those
in
others
75
lasted,
years.
Yeah, and those others lasted like 2 minutes, except Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
Steve Allen was one, he is considered the one who is the most important in many ways.
Important and innovative. And
yeah.
I think, you know, when I'm going to digress and say when David Letterman went on the air, he very much used Steve Allen. He revered Johnny Carson, but he loved the antics and the skits and the jumping with a Velcro suit onto a wall was very much Steve Allen. And so 5 years after the first late night show, which was Faye Emerson and then Broadway Open House, Steve Allen came along and really changed what that, it was called Tonight with Steve Allen. And what that was all about. I mean, he wanted to make people laugh at night. And certainly wasn't talking politics or anything else, but it was conversational, but it was about him having fun.
And also launching careers.
No, very much so.
Yeah, Tom Poston.
Yeah.
And Barney Fife, that would be...
Yeah, it would be Don Knotts.
Yeah.
In front of the camera and behind the camera, he launched a lot of folks. And then when Jack Parr took over, it was different. It was more of an intellectual conversation. It was almost like...
He brought in some politics.
It was almost a little Milt Rosenberg that was happening on the... It was. It was, again, Tonight with Jack Parr. And Jack brought a lot of drama to late night, and he would get ticked off at the network telling him what to do, and he would just walk off the set and so forth. So finally he said, you know, I got better things to do than deal with this. And Johnny was hosting a game show, and he had some other shows before that. He had something called Carson's Cellar and the Johnny Carson Show and the Squirrel's Nest. Really, he was on the air for 12 years before he got to the Tonight Show.
Right, and they called, and he was on a variety of game shows as a...
Who Do You Trust?
Yeah. Well, that was his own, but he was on other game shows as well as a panelist.
Yes, he was.
And they called him an overnight success, which he wasn't, and he wasn't, because he paid his dues.
That's right. I would say all the early shows that he did with his name on it didn't go very well. But Who Do You Trust? And being a panelist on these game shows allowed Johnny to come out of his shell. And he was a shy guy. You know, we tell the story, and we have Johnny's Magic book, that doing magic is what he knew. He had to be more, a little bit more social in his own world in high school, and then as he went on to the University of Nebraska, and magic was his key to do that. But he was listening to network executives telling him who he needed to be, and when he was on those game shows and did Who Do You Trust, it was a little bit more free-flowing, and that's why NBC said, you know what, let's take a chance, and I love it, let's take a chance on this guy who did it for 30 years.
Yeah, exactly right. And one of a friend of yours, and I knew her from the animal side of what she did, was Betty White.
Mm-hmm.
And Betty White and Johnny Carson shared an agent, which mm-hmm. I talked about with you at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
She was on the show many, 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 many times, actually. Not only as a guest, but doing skits.
Absolutely.
And also, there was a period of time when she married Alan Ludden, that she and Alan Ludden, the game show host of Password, they were the butt of Johnny's jokes.
They were. And Betty, when she would come on the show after he, like, could be days, could be a couple weeks after that, she just gave him hell.
Yeah, exactly.
On the show.
Exactly. But I asked her, I said, well, you must have known him fairly well because you were on the show so often, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you know what she said.
Nobody knew him well.
Right.
Nobody knew him well. And there was something I think I mentioned to you when you came and visited this past week, is that Betty was a guest on his show in the late 80s, and Johnny said to Betty, so you are involved in this museum in Chicago, because our first board members were Steve Allen, Betty White, Paul and Angel Harvey,
like
legendary. And Betty said, yeah, I'm being honored this week at the museum. And oh my gosh, you know, like, this is the coolest thing, Johnny. What you can do is you can go pick something to watch in their library and take it to a cubicle and watch it while you're there. And you know, we also, you could call sports games with Jack Brickhouse. There was other things, be at the news desk. I think it was Comcast at the time. You could do a newscast and they would record it and give you a tape. But it really told me how much the museum, you know, needed to evolve, obviously, over the years, and especially now. One of the most frequent tapes that would be rented were the three pilots to All in the Family. I think thousands of times, you know, whether it was a student from Columbia or Northwestern, DePaul, or just anybody wanting to come see it, there were three pilots for, you know, two for ABC in the 60s, years before it went on the air. Always Carol O'Connor, always Gene Stapleton, different kids, and people just found it fascinating. Same set, how it would just evolve. And
the other thing I found fascinating, yeah, is Carol O'Connor was in reality like 46 or 48 years
young.
Old.
He was so young.
And yeah, you wouldn't know it.
No.
He was a very good actor.
I think
actually.
I look better than Carol O'Connor on All in the Family now, and I'm in my late 50s.
You look better than some.
Yeah.
So getting back to late night TV.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's talk about Dick Cavett.
Oh, I forgot. This is your show. You can say that. Go ahead.
Well, for the moment.
Yes, yeah. But no, but Dick Cavett. Again, ABC, you know, if you're going to compete against Johnny, you can't exactly do Johnny's show. And he would have guest hosts with him, and he would have deep, long-form conversations with them. That's how he made himself
but with
a little
the
different.
Big names.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And one of those was Groucho Marx, who was frequently on, right?
But, you know this, too. Even when you're doing radio, you do something for a segment or two, and then it's over. To be able to talk to somebody for a full hour is rare. You know,
I thought it was over now. Are we done?
We're going to break.
No, yeah, we are. We're not done. David Plyer is here from WGN and the Museum of Broadcast Communications. I'll tell you, man, it looks amazing. It is absolutely terrific.
Thank you, sir.
And we're going to go into Genie's Bottle when we come back as well. I want to know who the interior designer was. We'll find out when we come back with David Plyer on
720 WGN.
Thank you, sir. So one of the last interviews I've ever done, David Plyer from WGN and of the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last interviews she ever did, maybe it was the last interview she did, was with me, that I did with Joan Rivers. And I will say, I don't know this, I've not talked to her daughter, I don't think I've ever spoken to her daughter, but my thinking is that to her dying day, she had no idea, really, why Johnny Carson said, I don't want to talk to you anymore after she went on and did her own show. And in any case, she was hurt by it.
Yeah. She had talked to, Henry Bushkin, which was, he put out a book, and she had him on a radio show when she was filling in. Henry Bushkin was Johnny Carson's attorney, who really had the inside track on Johnny. But at some point, they kind of had a falling out. And it really came down to, I mean, she revered him, she loved him, and he loved her. You know, back then it was like now in some worlds of broadcasting and media and so forth, it's a guy's place. You know, it's not a place for, you know, a woman to rise, and you know,
especially not then, and especially not in comedy.
No, and you know, they thought enough of her to give her the role of a permanent guest host, but really weren't considering her for anything else beyond that. And the issue was, she was rightfully nervous, scared to tell him that she got another job offer. And, you know, even though she never heard it from Johnny's lips, the fact that she didn't, I don't know if she would have gotten his permission, but the fact that he had to find out, you know, whether it was after the press conference or whatever happened, was the reason he felt betrayed. And I think that betrayal isn't just because she was going against him. It was because she did not tell him in advance. And she was devastated, really, for the rest of her life. And Leno kept her off the Tonight Show for as long as he hosted it. And I don't think Conan had her on either. But when Fallon got there, Jimmy finally did. And she felt like finally, 30 years, not able to appear on the Tonight Show.
Yeah, and she was incredible. In fact, and that she was so quick on her feet. Is that the secret to being a late night host?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You have to be obviously very topical, but you absolutely have to have that wit, and she had it. And it's a shame that her talk show didn't last as long as it did, because she got such negative press because she was a woman going against Johnny Carson. You know,
you think that's what killed
pre Arsenio? I think people didn't accept a woman in that role. And obviously, in 75 years, as we said, 75 years, there's only been four or five women that have hosted a late night show.
Mm-hmm.
Why hasn't America truly accepted that? It is a boy. When Letterman retired, you know, Chris Rock came out there and said, thanks, CBS, for giving the show to another white guy. Like, there's just no, there isn't. Yeah. There's not a lot of diversity and a lack of women in late night television.
You mentioned Arsenio. I think he's forgotten about, and how successful in a sense that he was, ratings some extent, having A-listers as guests, definitely.
He was legitimately a competitor, you know.
So what happened?
Well, I will say this: when Merv or when anybody else, Pat Sajak, anybody else,
Merv
did a late
Griffin,
night show,
did
a talk show, and the show was canceled, and that Friday. On Monday, Johnny would have him on that person on the show just to give him crap. And
he did with Merv Griffin, by the way, before. So Merv Griffin was on The Tonight Show, I think, once. And he had just announced, he hadn't literally left, but he had announced he was leaving. Yeah. And that's when Carson had him on.
Johnny did the exit interviews for every late night show that went against him. But when it came to, you know, people like Arsenio, as you were mentioning, he was legitimately competition because he was pulling in a younger demographic. And it wasn't just a, you know, African-American. It wasn't just a black demographic. He was pulling in young people to that show. He had the right guests. He had the right music on that show. And at that point, Johnny was doing it 27 years, 28 years, getting maybe a little long in the tooth as far as the type of music he was welcoming into the show.
Mm-hmm.
He still had some very contemporary guests, but I think the music really did play a significant role for Arsenio.
Yeah, interesting to say, but there is music that begins certain television shows that you hear the theme and you instantly know.
Used to.
What do you mean?
Well, there's TV themes aren't a thing anymore.
Well, you know, I suppose like you're right. Yeah. But I'm trying to do the classy transition.
Okay, sorry.
And I Dream a Genie would be one of those themes, wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's the composer?
Hugo Montenegro.
Oh, was it really?
Yes.
Okay. Man,
this are we queuing that? Are we?
No. Okay, would have been a good idea, or better to have Genie pop into the studio. Tell me about 60 years. I can't believe it's been 60 years of I Dream a Genie.
Well, it's funny, when we first started this project, I had noticed that Antenna TV had done a smaller version of this at the upfronts, and upfronts were in May, and upfronts are when TV networks kind of preview, you know, it's everyone goes to New York and have these presentations of what's coming on in the fall, and you walk through their showroom, so to speak. And so they had the inside of the genie bottle, but smaller. And I had just run into somebody on the floor here, and I said, hey, you know, can we do that for the museum? I like had one little, you know, one little spot left that I was thinking about, and it was like, yeah, I think so, and I think we can fund it.
Has the rent gone up?
Yeah, I don't think that. Well,
no rent control.
No, because no one's really been in there. Very few people have been in there. And
what's it like in there?
Like in there?
Yeah,
well, it was a banquette with a very
a love seat, I imagine.
Yeah, love seat in there. You know, purple walls, some jewels on the walls, and so forth, and. We said, okay, let's figure this out. How do we, you know, what do we want to do with this? And we actually started talking to Barbara Eden herself. She was going to actually be there for the opening. She's 94. She just did Bill Maher's Club Random podcast, which was incredible for over an hour. But her husband's ill, and she's like, I'm not going to travel right now because I don't know what's happening. But she was
she
all in.
Still sounds great.
She sounds and looks great.
Yeah,
looks great.
Yeah.
And we said, well, let's make sure we do this, but let's tell a deeper story. And so we obviously told the story of the show. We also share a lot of images from behind the scenes that are a little more rare that people don't see of the magic and how they did some of that. And then we tell the story about the Jim Beam decanter that became the genie bottle.
Explain that.
So Jim Beam in the 60s and 70s, I'm sure a lot of listeners know this too, they did a lot of collectible decanters. So when it was the bicentennial in 1976, there was a bicentennial. There was ones by state, very well themed. There was a James Bond one. There was a Mustang one that was literally shaped as a Mustang that had bourbon in it. And they were doing these early on, and in, I think it was 63 or 64, I think it was 63, they were doing a Christmas bottle. Why it was Christmas, I'll never know. It was a green blown glass, and the prop guy that was helping putting together the pilot was, I think, just going for his weekend allotment of bourbon, and seriously, and saw this bottle and was like, and bought a couple of them and took them home and painted it over the next few days and brought it into the studio, and they were like, yeah, okay, that's the bottle. And that became the genie bottle.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Speaking of bourbon, you're going to have some bourbon tastings at the museum?
Well, yeah. So Thursday nights, we're going to do late night at the museum. Our first one, and it's going to be various things. It's going to be book signings. I know Bill Curtis is going to do a book signing and Q&A for his new book, Legend in Broadcasting. But Mark Malkoff, who's also has done the Carson podcast, just put out a new book on Johnny Carson. So Thursday night, 6 to 8, we're going to do a little Q&A. This Thursday, this coming Thursday. And we invite everybody to come if you want to come after work and check it out and do a little, pardon me? Yeah.
Address?
Oh, 440 West Randolph. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, we're going to do some other things too. Goose Island's a sponsor. While I was late to one of our scheduled conversations
before.
Yeah,
you're coming up. Booth 46, that'll be dropping this coming Friday, yeah. I believe, and we talk more about the Museum of Broadcast Communications,
and we're going to do a Bourbon County Stout tasting there, which is really cool.
Do
and
you know who you've got someone on staff who's expert about that?
No, we're going to bring Goose Island in. No.
You have someone on staff also who's expert on that. You know who I'm speaking of?
You must be talking about me.
No,
oh, Brian Noonan.
Yes, exactly.
Brian Noonan. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, he and I both do these things together very quietly. But yes, now it's going to be very public. But yeah, we're going to do a Bourbon County Stout tasting. We're going to do some wine tasting, but we want to do some things on Thursday nights, just giving an opportunity. There's thousands of people that walk by this museum every day to go to the train.
Yeah.
It's a lot of young people. We got to yank them in there and to do some things. I think booze and comedy. We're also going to do Pat McGann, comedian. He's going to do an evening event. I think Jeff Ross, the Roastmaster General, is going to do some, do an event for us on a Thursday night. But Thursday nights are the hot spot, I think, a new one for the museum.
And you have a website that shows all that?
Yes, sir. So tickets, you can buy tickets in advance. You can buy tickets at the door. You can find out what's going on at museum.tv.
Museum.tv. Somehow that seems right. And in fact, it's not only television, it's radio as well, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got a small Radio Hall of Fame. I will tell you, the Radio Hall of Fame was in Chicago, and we got a lot of Radio Hall of Famers in, and they're like, where's my plaque? And I'm like, well, most people under 50 don't want to look at a plaque. They want to look and be interactive. So you can pull up a Radio Hall of Fame inductee. look at their picture, their bio, and listen to some of their work.
I can ask you where my plot is, but that's a different thing.
Plot and plaque. And then we have an exhibit on The Loop, the old 97.9 FM.
Heard of them.
5 decades of The Loop. Johnny, Kevin Matthews, and
Wendy Snyder.
Wendy Snyder, yep. and Bob Stroud. So it's a little bit of the music side and the comedy side, but The Loop exhibit has gotten Rick Camper curated that and wrote it, and a lot of great buzz for that, too.
I don't know him, but he is amazing, and a lot of great buzz for what we're going to hear on the radio having to do with the museum in just a couple of hours.
Yeah. Oh yes, absolutely. Oh, hello.
I'm trying to help you out here.
You really are, Steve. Yeah, the Radio Hall of Fame that was Thursday night here in Chicago is airing today on WGN Radio at 5 o'clock. So even though you might not know some of the personalities, I mean, just to hear their passion for this business and being on there and the passion for their listeners is pretty incredible.
Indeed. And I'll tell you, once again, I didn't know what to expect when I walked in necessarily, and I'm being totally honest with you. I told you at the time, but everyone needs to hear. If you are interested in broadcasting, whether you're a young person maybe who wants to go into broadcasting, you like television history, as you and I do both, you will love the Museum of Broadcast Communications. It's really great.
By the way,
for the videos that you don't see, there are QR codes everywhere.
Everywhere.
So you could just call them up on your phone.